Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. And I'm speaking to you from a nearly empty office in Washington, D.C., where the mayor has declared a state of emergency due to the spread of the coronavirus, COVID-19. Odds are, if you're listening to this episode when it comes out, wherever you are, you're probably in a place where officials have already closed or about to close a lot of things. News saturation for the pandemic feels like it's at an all-time high. But one thing is glaringly missing from the coverage: the underlying structural reasons for why this is happening. Rob Wallace is an evolutionary biologist at the Institute for Global Studies at the University of Minnesota. For the past 25 years, he's been studying the evolution and spread of influenzas and other pathogens. He's consulted on the flu for the United Nations and the CDC, and he's the author of the book Big Farms Make Big Flu. His research shows that if you really want to understand the nature of global disease outbreaks, you have to look at global agriculture. Where are large industrial farms or monoculture plantations encroaching on forests that are home to wild animals, that are the natural hosts for pathogens like Ebola and this new coronavirus? Who has pushed people off their subsistence farms deeper into forests and hinterlands that used to be able to regulate themselves before half their ecosystem was destroyed? Who is really to blame here? Rob Wallace joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota, to talk about his work on connecting pathogens to agriculture. Thanks so much, Rob.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here, though I wish it was under other circumstances.
So it seems like for as long as I've been an adult, there have been more and deadlier novel virus outbreaks. And you've been writing about these epidemics for 25 years, which is only slightly less long than I've been alive. So how does coronavirus fit in with a litany of recent outbreaks, from Ebola to SARS to all the different animal flus? And is it just me, or does it seem like they're coming faster and harder than before?
You're right. I mean, they totally feel, and they are indeed, coming fast and furiously almost on an annual basis at this point. There's H5N1, the avian influenza that emerged in 1997, SARS in 2002-2003, and we had MERS, swine flu influenza 2009, Ebola 2013, and Zika, and now we're here with coronavirus. And you know, we have other pathogens circulating that seem to be on the verge of perhaps becoming more serious. And right now we have African swine fever, which emerged out of Africa in the 50s and 60s, spilled over to Europe for a little bit. But since in the last 3 or 4 years, has spilled across Eurasia into China and has killed half of China's hog. So on the one hand, yes, it's part of this continuum. On the other hand, this one seems to be particularly special because it's hit the right mix of virulence, how much damage it does to humans, and infectivity, the capacity to go human to human. And so what were previously kind of proto-pandemic diseases that didn't quite make the pandemic cut, SARS or 2009, the swine flu, that did go pandemic, but it didn't have as much of a serious connotation as this one has. But this one has that mix of infectivity and virulence in a way that, without being alarmist about it, may be in a position to kill many more people than some of the other ones that got us to this point.
And how much of that can be chalked up to the virus itself, and how much to just the way that global networks have become even closer since SARS?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, those two things are very much interrelated to each other. So on the one hand, those long thought that most pathogens that are very virulent, that kill their hosts really fast, cut off their own chain of transmission, meaning if you kill your host too fast, then you're not able to get into the next host, and so you die off. So, you know, we had Ebola coming out since 1976, would take out a village or two or a troop of guerrillas. I mean, it's a gruesome thing, but it was basically caught out in the hinterlands of forested Africa, and there was no thought that it would go pandemic. But what's changed here is both in East Africa and West Africa and across the world is that pathogens that are able to make it out of their hinterland origins make their way into the local capital and then get up on a plane and spread around the world. Our travels become much more integrated. Even since SARS, there's something like 700% increase in travel within China, something that's able to make its way out onto the travel network. And by virtue of being able to access so many susceptible populations around the world so quickly, it can get away with being a virulent pathogen, meaning it might kill people really quickly, but because the next host is already right there, it's able to keep its chain of transmission going. And because we're so much more integrated, pathogens that were previously unable to get out on the global stage are now able to do so.
Yeah, I mean, there seem to be still so many open questions about the coronavirus, but you wrote this February piece about how agriculture is connected to the coronavirus. And reading it now a few weeks later, it still seems right on the money in a lot of ways. Despite everything we don't know about the future of this virus, it seems like we can deduce a lot from past viruses and how they've broken out.
Why don't we start off with the coronavirus at this point? A lot of attention was paid to that wet market in Wuhan from which it appears the new cases began to accumulate. And so there are a lot of exotic foods that are sold there. Civets, you know, you might have snakes sold. You have all sorts of wild animals. You know, there was the distinct contrast between that kind of agricultural production and industrial agriculture, you know, your typical poultry and hogs. But I came to the conclusion that those two things are intimately related to each other, including and particularly for China. Since the kind of economic liberalization that China has undergone for the past 40 years, the exotic food market has become increasingly formalized in the sense that it's not just a local farmer bringing a few things off the truck. I mean, now it's being increasingly capitalized. So some of the money that's backing and increasing industrialization of it, as it were, of these kind of exotic foods is also the money that's backing traditional industrial agriculture. And there's also a kind of economic geography in this as well. As industrial agriculture expands out into the hinterlands, it puts pressure, it's a competition with exotic species on small farms or local farmers having to go deeper and deeper into the forest regions to be able to obtain the animals they need to supply the city markets. In other words, there's a spatial relationship between the two types of production. As the two types actually go more into the forest, then you have an increase in the interface between wild reservoirs. You increase the interface, increase the spillover rate, and as the spillover is directly into humans or into the wild food species or the more industrial species, those animals are subsequently shipped back into the city for processing or direct sale. And so we've developed a kind of agricultural system in such a way that we have a direct pipeline from the deepest reservoirs of pathogens in the forest directly right into the city. So that's coronavirus. It's a marker of how things are operating elsewhere and how the economic geography of agriculture is a direct cause for how these pathogens are emerging.
If you're comparing the coronavirus and like the avian flu, for example, I'd just love if you could spell out a little bit more explicitly how you can compare an avian flu that started in like the heart of agribusiness. Maybe we can use the example of the avian flu that started in the Midwest, in the American Midwest, on factory farms. How can you compare something like that with, you know, a coronavirus or some other pathogen that is happening sort of on the borders of industrial agriculture?
We can compare these pathogens because they are in different parts of the same geography. your examples apt. The H5N2 influenza that emerged full force here in the Midwest in 2015 emerged out of industrial turkey and broilers and layers. While coronavirus seems to very much emerge out of bats out in the hinterlands, we have this circuit going on in which pathogens are able to circulate across different host types. So avian influenza can emerge out of wild waterfowl. And wild waterfowl, their wetlands are increasingly being destroyed and turned into cropland. And so industrial ag is in the business of destroying the primary environments in which many of these wild animals exist. But many of these animals, they're not rolling over and dying once their environment is destroyed. They have agency and they make choices, and they've decided to move into more agriculture areas to be able to survive and exist. Here in the United States, many of the geese populations used to summer over along the wetlands of the Gulf of Mexico when that wetlands were destroyed and turned into developments. Geese and other wild waterfowl started to migrate up into all the farms that extend across the Midwest as north of Minnesota. And so their populations increased as they fed on the cropland. You could say the same for bats in West Africa. As transnational capital comes in to develop the forest regions for clear-cut mining, for industrial agriculture, many of the host species die off along with their pathogens, but some host species are able to respond well, and they make adjustments. And so our example is that of palm oil. Many of the frugivore bats who eat fruit, who are also reservoirs for Ebola, made their way into these large palm oil operations. I mean, what's not to like? I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, there's no predators. There's all this space for you to fly between your roosting and forage sites. You also have an increased interface with humans, and so the pathogens that they are hosting increasingly spill over into the humans. So you have two things going on. One, you have a widening circuit of agricultural production and trade that extends increasingly deeper into the forest and back out into the city. And you also have a change in the ecologies of the host species that were typically confined to the deepest forests and are now being increasingly bumped up against peri-urban regions in which humans are concentrated. And it isn't just bats. It isn't just birds. Mosquitoes are now changing their ecological geographies in such a way that what were previously species of mosquitoes that were constrained to a wild forest are now making their way into rural areas and even into cities.
Yeah, I mean, I think your work on Ebola, specifically with like the policy changes and agribusiness practices that preceded each major Ebola outbreak from the past, like, half century,
right,
really undermines the way we've treated these outbreaks as these like random natural disasters that will just happen. So can you summarize your findings on Ebola with those outbreaks and what it says about our disaster response?
Right. Well, we look back into literature and discover that every single Ebola outbreak was preceded by an influx of capital. What were ostensibly rural smallholder production or even just agroforestry was foundationally shifted in a way that would unplug the typical ecological relations and replug them in different ways. What were previously isolated populations of wild reservoirs on one hand, say the bats, and humans, local humans, were put back together in a way that permitted Ebola to spill over at a rate that it hadn't previously. So all the way back to 1976, first outbreak in southern Sudan, you had at the time in 1972, the end of the Civil War then. There was an influx of people back into the area, and forest was cut down again for cotton production, rejiggered the ecological relationships, and increased the interface between the humans and the bats that are the reservoirs for Ebola. And so all along the way, almost all the outbreaks that we looked at show that to be the case. And indeed, you can go back through history and find that just about every new pathogen is preceded by these exact kinds of changes. So if you want to go back to the emergence of HIV, some of the phylogeography, looking at the genetics of HIV, were able to pinpoint the origins of SIV, the immunodeficiency virus that spilled over into humans, became HIV, emerged out of southeastern Cameroon at a time in which the French and the Germans were competing over the area and turning what was subsistence bushmeat into something that was more of an industry to supply the gangs of workers who were cutting down forest and tapping rubber and shipping all the stuff to the coastline. So there's another example of a changing economic geography that allowed a pathogen that had probably for hundreds of years, if not thousands, spilled over into humans, all of a sudden get the epidemiological momentum that it didn't have previous and make its way down into the Congo and subsequently onto the international travel network.
Like the natural outgrowth, of course, of these narratives, and we've seen this with coronavirus, we saw it with Ebola too, is these xenophobic, sinophobic, sort of racist characterizations of people's eating habits being to blame. The Chinese are to blame for their culinary habits, if only they didn't eat bats, or that Chinese doctors got things wrong. But beyond the harm that they cause on an individual level, you know, racist attacks against people who look Asian in England or Italy, what's dangerous about these outbreak narratives?
Well, certainly racializing these outbreaks really has a way of dividing us from the critical notion that we are all interrelated at this point in fundamental ways. In some sense, you know, many an epidemiologist has a certain exhaustion coming out of coronavirus, if only because, you know, we've seen this multiple times in every effort to raise the alarm to say, hey, we need to change our agricultural practices, change how we interrelate with wild hinterlands, has been largely ignored in part because the entirety of civilization at this point and our means of socially reproducing ourselves as a species involves pretending that we can continue to cut into the forests and grow species in a way that select for the most dangerous pathogens and not suffer the consequences of it. You know, we could be doing things differently in a way that could at least strike a detente with these pathogens so that we don't select for the most virulent pathogens that are able to crisscross the world.
So, I mean, how? How can we stop these outbreaks from, emerging in the first place if our response now is so lackadaisical? I mean, it seems like we've learned nothing from a public health perspective since SARS, since Ebola, since every single one of these.
All right. Well, and again, that's one of the dangers of looking at this as individual outbreaks. You know, we freak out and worry about the outbreaks themselves, as we should. And that's what gets at the notion that treating this as an emergency is actually absolutely correct. But the problem is that we're using the emergencies as a way of avoiding talking about the structural causes for the outbreaks that happened in the first place. And those two things, again, you have your false dichotomy. Those two things are competing with each other in a way that allows the systems that produce the pathogens in the first place to continue on. And, you know, don't get me wrong, we should deal with the emergency aspect of it. But the emergencies serve as a way of clearing the room of any other discussion. And that includes the structural causes for the outbreaks, in part because there's considerable amount to be gained from keeping the structures in place, at least for some individuals. Agribusiness is one of the most formidable and well-paid sectors of the economy, and they have considerable amount of power. I always joke in a really dark way that some of these pathogens have the best lawyers on the planet. Agribusiness has the means and the power to be able to make sure that its practices are not changed, that it can continue to make considerable quarterly profit, but that comes at a considerable cost. Presently, the sector is capable of externalizing its costs, meaning throwing the costs on everybody else in terms of any one of these outbreaks. You can always blame a virus, right? So we already know that it has nothing to do with the agriculture producer, so it's claimed. But you know, if you look at their operations, I couldn't think of a better way of growing a virulent pathogen. Here you're stacking in thousands of hog or poultry in a single barn. They're all genetically the same, so there's no diversity to act as a kind of immune firebreak. It makes for easy transmission from hog to hog. It causes immune depression. As these animals aren't allowed to reproduce on site, if a deadly pathogen were to come in and there were a few left standing, we would think, okay, those are the the hog that we're going to use to breed the next generation, because somehow some trick of their immunogenetics allows them to survive. Well, hog and poultry and other industrial livestock are not allowed to breed on site. They don't do that. So we've cut out a major ecosystem service that for us. We've removed natural selection from our ability to control these pathogens and be able to respond to them evolutionarily in real time. So what I would do is change agriculture in its entirety. I mean, many smallholders and farmers around the world engage in what's called regenerative agriculture or agroecology, already doing many of these things. They have diverse combinations of livestock and poultry. They allow the animals to reproduce on site. They don't batch them in together in the thousands. And because of the diversity, their animals can act as immune firebreaks. If a pathogen comes and knocks down one herd, because the herds nearby are different, they're unlikely to be as badly infected or at all. So you need to reintroduce the kind of geographic diversity in animal production and crop production as well to keep pathogens from being able to ramp up and spread and evolve greater deadliness.
Well, what about interventions like genetically modifying chickens to outmaneuver these pathogens? Is that feasible?
Well, I mean, that's certainly one thing that they're looking at. And my take on it is that agribusiness is losing control of the narrative of food. You know, whether it's danger to public health or whether it's the reduction of nitrogen in the food that's produced, all of a sudden in the past 20 years, that narrative is no longer in big ag's control. There's a certain kind of adventurism that comes in on the part of agribusiness to try to deal with these increasing problems that up until now they've just been able to externalize onto everybody else. And so you'll have examples of attempts to use lasers to keep wild waterfowl from coming onto farms that raise poultry. There's a push toward doing face recognition software for hog. I'm not sure how that's going to help them at all. And genetic modification that you can somehow loop out the receptor site that a pathogen might be able to attach onto a host cell. But what they don't tell you is that if indeed we could do that for animals or livestock and a pathogen isn't able to infect the animals, well, they're not going to be doing it to us humans. So it can still circulate in such a way that it might be able to pop out into humans. And so what I'm getting at here is that there's so much effort on this kind of adventurism, an attempt to try to modify all aspects of animal production except the economic model that's underlying the mass production of industrial poultry and hog.
Right. I mean, in a lot of ways, it seems like the technological interventions that are being proposed to fight climate change, let's change everything but what's actually causing it. Or even in the, you know, the health response in China, like, you know, using drones to tell people to put on masks or amping up surveillance through technology. Well, maybe if you spent the past couple of decades amping up public health, that could have stopped it too.
Oh, absolutely. My take on it is that increasingly public health is a part of the commons that are being spun off and sold, including in the epidemiologies. Even some of the basic information are increasingly being privatized or securitized in the sense of being considered national security. Everyday scientists are having difficulty even discerning where some of the outbreaks are actually happening. Puts us in a place where the basic commons, what all of us need to do together to deal with a public health crisis, is being put in danger.
Okay, so to close, I mean, what do you think we should be doing, every one of us, to stop the spread of the coronavirus on an individual level?
On the individual level, we certainly should do our best to stay calm. Clearly, we should wash our hands. If we can, it'd be wonderful to engage in some self-quarantine if it calls for it. But some of these things aren't possible. I mean, we're at a moment where, like many a pandemic, a pathogen serves as a mirror for our society. And it shows us that we are ill-prepared in many ways, and not just merely at the level of what this particular administration has done, but more broadly speaking, what modes of production and means by which we organize our society, frankly, around producing profit. We engaged in widening the gap between our economies and our ecologies. we are, in essence, selecting for some of the worst possible outcomes so that someone's able to make a buck. And somehow we're going to have to reconnect our ecologies and economies in a way that allows us to continue to draw from nature what we need to survive, but not in such a way that we smash nature and generate the problems of public health exposures or, as you brought up, climate change, so that we can have a situation where we can continue to exist on this planet from generation to generation. Well, that's going to involve certainly much more than merely an individual response, as we must most certainly do in terms of getting through this coronavirus. But we can't just then bury our head in the sands and just wait for the next emergency. In the end, we'll have to change this. I mean, there's no way that we can continue to allow a means of production that appears on the verge, if not COVID-19, then it'll be another pathogen that may emerge to kill a billion people. I mean, at some point we have to say, no, we can't do this anymore.
Epidemiology can be difficult stuff to parse on a good day, let alone on one where you're washing your hands every 20 minutes and trying not to freak out. We have links in the show notes to some of Rob Wallace's work, including a really clear article he wrote for the Monthly Review that lays out a lot of the arguments he discussed in this episode. We're also going to be publishing a weekly update on our website, theamericanscholar.org, from Philip Alcabes, a professor of public health, and we've got a link to his first primer on COVID-19 in the show notes as well. Stay safe out there. Stay home if you can. Check in on your loved ones. And as ever, stay sharp.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.